been away at the time, on vacation. People like the Cambers didn't ordinarily take vacations, but Charity Camber had won some money in the state lottery, Ace seemed to recall. He tried to remember more, but it was hazy in his mind. He'd had his own fish to fry back then, plenty of them. What had Mrs. Camber done when she and her boy had returned from their little trip to find that Joe, a world-class shit, according to everything Ace had heard, was dead and gone? Moved out of state, hadn't they? And the property? Maybe she'd wanted to turn it over in a hurry. In Castle Rock, one name stood above all the rest when it came to turning things over in a hurry. That name was Reginald Marion Pop Merrill. Had she gone to see him? He would have offered her short commons, that was his way, but if she was anxious enough to move, short commons might have been okay with her. In other words, the Camber place might also have belonged to Pop at the time of his death. This possibility solidified to a certainty in Ace's mind only moments after it occurred to him. "The Camber place," he said. "I bet that's where it is. I know that's where it is. Thousands of dollars. Maybe tens of thousands. Hopping, Jesus." He snatched up the map and slammed it back into the book. Then he headed out to the Chevy Mr. Gaunt had loaned him, almost running. One question still nagged. If Pop really had been able to tell the difference between diamonds and dust, why had he bothered to bury the trading stamps at all? Ace pushed this question impatiently aside and got on the road to Castle Rock. Danforth Keaton arrived back home in Castle View just as Ace was leaving for the town's more rural environs. Buster was still handcuffed to the door handle of his Cadillac, but his mood was one of savage euphoria. He had spent the last 2 years fighting shadows, and the shadows had been winning. It had gotten to the point where he had begun fearing that he might be going insane, which, of course, was just what they wanted him to believe. He saw several satellite dishes on his drive from Main Street to his home on the View. He had noticed them before and had wondered if they might not be a part of what was going on in this town. Now he felt sure. They weren't satellite dishes at all. They were mind disruptors. They might not all be aimed at his house, but you could be sure any which weren't were aimed at the few other people like him who understood that a monstrous conspiracy was afoot. Buster parked in his driveway and pushed the garage door opener clipped to his sun visor. The door began to rise, but he felt a monstrous bolt of pain go through his head at the same instant. He understood that was a part of it, too. They had replaced his real wizard garage door opener with something else, something that shot bad rays into his head at the same time it was opening the door. He pulled it off the visor and threw it out the window before driving into the garage. He turned off the ignition, opened the door, and got out. The handcuff tethered him to the door as efficiently as a choke chain. There were tools mounted neatly on wall pegs, but they were well out of reach. Buster leaned back into the car and began to blow the horn. Myrtle Keaton, who'd had her own errand to run that afternoon, was lying on her bed upstairs in a troubled semi-doze when the horn began to blow. She sat bolt upright, eyes bulging in terror. "I did it," she gasped. "I did what you told me to do. Now please leave me alone." She realized that she had been dreaming, that Mr. Gaunt was not here, and let out her breath in a long, trembling sigh. Wonk, wonk, wonk. It sounded like the Cadillac's horn. She picked up the doll which lay next to her on the bed, the beautiful doll she had gotten at Mr. Gaunt's shop, and hugged it to her for comfort. She had done something this afternoon, something which a dim, frightened part of her believed to be a bad thing, a very bad thing, and since then the doll had become inexpressibly dear to her. Price, Mr. Gaunt might have said, always enhances value, at least in the eyes of the purchaser. Wonk! It was the Cadillac's horn. Why was Danforth sitting in the garage blowing his horn? She supposed she had better go see. "But he better not hurt my doll," she said in a low voice. She placed it carefully in the shadows under her side of the bed. He just better not, because that's where I draw the line. Myrtle was one of a great many people who had visited Needful Things that day, just another name with a check mark beside it on Mr. Gaunt's list. She had come, like many others, because Mr. Gaunt had told her to come. She got the message in a way her husband would have understood completely. She heard it in her head. Mr. Gaunt had told her the time had come to finish paying for her doll, if she wanted to keep it, that was. She was to take a metal box and a sealed letter to the Daughters of Isabella Hall next to Our Lady of Serene Waters. The box had grills set in every side but the bottom. She could hear a faint ticking noise from inside. She had tried to look into one of the round grills. They looked like the speakers in old-fashioned table radios, but she had been able to see only a vague cube-shaped object. And in truth, she hadn't looked very hard. It seemed better, safer, not to. There had been one car in the parking lot of the little church complex when Myrtle, who was on foot, arrived. The parish hall itself had been empty, though. She peeked over the sign taped to the window set in the top half of the door to make sure, then read the sign. Daughters of Isabella meet Tuesday at 7 p.m. Help us plan casino night. Myrtle slipped inside. To her left was a stack of brightly painted compartments standing against the wall. This was where the daycare children kept their lunches and where the Sunday school children kept their various drawings and work projects. Myrtle had been told to put her item into one of these compartments, and she did so. It just fit. At the front of the room was the chairwoman's table, with an American flag on the left and a banner depicting the Infant of Prague on the right. The table was already set up for the evening meeting with pens, pencils, casino night sign-up sheets, and, in the middle, the chairwoman's agenda. Myrtle had put the envelope Mr. Gaunt had given her under this sheet so Betsy Vigue, this year's Daughters of Isabella Activities chairwoman, would see it as soon as she picked up her agenda. "Read this right away, you pope whore," was typed across the front of the envelope in capital letters. Heart bumping rapidly in her chest, her blood pressure somewhere over the moon, Myrtle had tiptoed out of the Daughters of Isabella Hall. She paused for a moment outside, hand pressed above her ample bosom, trying to catch her breath, and saw someone hurrying out of the Knights of Columbus Hall beyond the church. It was June Gavinoe. She looked as scared and guilty as Myrtle felt. She raced down the wooden steps to the parking lot so fast she almost fell, and then walked rapidly toward that single-parked car, low heels tip-tapping briskly on the hot top. She looked up, saw Myrtle, and paled. Then she looked more closely at Myrtle's face and understood. "You too?" she asked in a low voice. A strange grin, both jolly and nauseated, rose on her face. It was the expression of a normally well-behaved child who has, for reasons she does not understand herself, put a mouse in her favorite teacher's desk drawer. Myrtle felt an answering grin of exactly the same type rise on her own face, yet she tried to dissemble. "Mercy's sake, I don't know what you're talking about." "Yes, you do." Junin looked around quickly, but the two women had this corner of that strange afternoon to themselves. "Mr. Gaunt." Myrtle nodded and felt her cheeks heat in a fierce, unaccustomed blush. "What did you get?" June asked.
"A doll. What did you get?"
"A vase. The most beautiful cloisonné vase you ever saw."
"What did you do?"
Smiling slyly, June countered. "What did you do?"
"Never mind."
Myrtle looked back toward the Daughters of Isabella Hall and then sniffed. "It doesn't matter anyway. They're only Catholics."
"That's right," June, who was a lapsed Catholic herself, replied.
Then she had gone to her car. Myrtle had not asked for a ride, and June Gavinoe did not offer one. Myrtle had walked rapidly out of the parking lot. She had not looked up when June shot by her in her white Saturn. All Myrtle had wanted was to go home, take a nap while she cuddled her lovely doll, and forget what she had done. That, she was now discovering, was not going to be as easy as she had hoped.
Wonk!
Buster planted his palm on the horn and held it down. The blare rang and blasted in his ears. Where in hell's name was that bitch? At last, the door between the garage and the kitchen opened. Myrtle poked her head through. Her eyes were large and frightened. "Well, finally," Buster said, letting go of the horn. "I thought you died on the John."
"Danforth? What's wrong?"
"Nothing. Things are better than they've been for 2 years. I just need a little help, that's all." Myrtle didn't move. "Woman, get your fat ass over here." She didn't want to go. He scared her. But the habit was old and deep and hard to break. She came around to where he stood in the wedge of space behind the car's open door. She walked slowly, her slippers scuffing the concrete floor in a way that made Buster grind his teeth together. She saw the handcuffs, and her eyes widened. "Danforth, what happened?"
"Nothing I can't handle. Pass me that hacksaw, Mert. The one on the wall. No, on second thought, never mind the hacksaw right now. Give me the big screwdriver instead, and that hammer."
She started to draw away from him, her hands going up to her chest and joining there in an anxious knot. Quick as a snake, moving before she could back out of his reach, Buster shot his free hand through the open window and seized her by the hair.
"Ow!" she screamed, grabbing futilely at his fist. "Danforth! Ow! Ow!"
Buster dragged her toward him, his face clenched in a horrible grimace. Two large veins pulsed in his forehead. He felt her hand beating against his fist no more than he would have felt a bird's wing.
"Get what I tell you!" he cried and pulled her head forward. He thumped it against the top of the open door once, twice, three times. "Were you born foolish or did you just grow that way? Get it! Get it! Get it!"
"Danforth, you're hurting me!"
"Right!"
he screamed back and thumped her head once more against the top of the Cadillac's open door, much harder this time. The skin of her forehead split and thin blood began to flow down the left side of her face.
"Are you going to mind me, woman?"
"Yes! Yes! Yes!"
"Good."
He relaxed his grip on her hair. "Now give me the big screwdriver and the hammer, and don't try any funny business either." She waved her right arm toward the wall.
"I can't reach."
He leaned forward, extending his own reach a little, and allowing her to take a step toward the wall where the tools hung. He kept his fingers wrapped firmly in her hair as she groped. Dime-sized drops of blood splattered on and between her slippers. Her hand closed on one of the tools, and Danforth shook her head briskly, the way a terrier might shake a dead rat.
"Not that, Dumbo," he said. "That's a drill. Did I ask for a drill, huh?"
"But Danforth, ow! I can't see!"
"I suppose you'd like me to let you go. Then you could run into the house and call them, couldn't you?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Oh, no. You're such an innocent little lamb. It was just an accident that you got me out of the way on Sunday so that fucking deputy could put them lying stickers up all over the house. Is that what you expect me to believe?"
She looked back at him through the tangles of her hair. Blood had formed fine beads in her eyelashes.
But Danforth, you asked me out on Sunday. You said..."
He jerked hard on her hair. Myrtle screamed.
"Just get what I asked for. We can discuss this later."
She fell along the wall again, head down, hair, except for Buster's fistful, hanging in her face. Her groping fingers touched the big screwdriver.
"That's one," he said. "Let's try for two. What do you say?"
She fumbled some more, and at last her fluttering fingers happened on the perforated rubber sleeve which covered the handle of the craftsman hammer.
"Good. Now give 'em to me."
She pulled the hammer off its pegs, and Buster reeled her in. He let go of her hair, ready to snatch a fresh handful if she showed any sign of bolting. Myrtle didn't. She was cowed. She only wanted to be allowed back upstairs, where she would cuddle her beautiful doll to her and go to sleep. She felt like sleeping forever. He took the tools from her unresisting hands. He placed the tip of the screwdriver against the door handle, then whacked the top of the screwdriver several times with the hammer. On the fourth blow, the door handle snapped off. Buster slipped the loop of the cuff out of it, then dropped both the handle and the screwdriver to the concrete floor. He went first to the button which closed the garage door. Then, as it rattled noisily down on its tracks, he advanced on Myrtle with the hammer in his hand. Did you sleep with him, Myrtle? He asked softly.
What?
She looked at him with dull, apathetic eyes. Buster began to whack the hammerhead into the palm of his hand. It made a soft, fleshy sound. Thuck, thuck, thuck. Did you sleep with him after the two of you put up those goddamn pink slips all over the house? She looked at him dully, not understanding, and Buster himself had forgotten that she had been with him at Maurice when Ridgwick broke in and did his thing.
Buster, what are you talking about?
He stopped, his eyes widening.
What did you call me?
The apathy left her eyes. She began to retreat from him, hunching her shoulders protectively. Behind them, the garage door came to rest. Now the only sounds in the garage were their scuffling feet and the soft clink of the handcuff chain as it swung back and forth.
I'm sorry, she whispered. I'm sorry, Danforth.
Then she turned and ran for the kitchen door. He caught her 3 steps from it, once again using her hair to draw her to him.
What did you call me?
He screamed and raised the hammer. Her eyes turned to follow its ascent.
Danforth, no, please!
What did you call me? What did you call me?
He screamed it over and over again, and each time he asked the question, he punctuated it with that soft, fleshy sound. Thuck, thuck, thuck. Ace drove into the Camber dooryard at 5 o'clock. He stuffed the treasure map into his back pocket, then opened the trunk. He got the pick and shovel, which Mr. Godd had thoughtfully provided, and then walked over to the leaning, overgrown porch, which ran along one side of the house. He took the map out of his back pocket and sat on the steps to examine it. The short-term effects of the coke had worn off, but his heart was still thudding briskly along in his chest. Treasure hunting, he had discovered, was also a stimulant. He looked around for a moment at the weedy yard, the sagging barn, the clusters of blindly staring sunflowers. It's not much, but I think this is it just the same, he thought. The place where I put the Corson brothers behind me forever and get rich in the bargain. It's here, some of it or all of it. Right here. I can feel it. But it was more than a feeling. He could hear it. Singing softly to him, singing from beneath the ground. Not just tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands, perhaps as much as a million.
$1 million,
Ace whispered in a hushed, choked voice and bent over the map. 5 minutes later, he was hunting along the west side of the Camber house. Most of the way down toward the back, almost obscured in tall weeds, he found what he was looking for, a large, flat stone. He picked it up, threw it aside, and began to dig frantically. Less than 2 minutes later, there was a muffled clunk as the blade struck rusty metal. Ace fell on his knees, rooted in the dirt like a dog hunting a buried bone, and a minute later he unearthed the Sherwin-Williams paint can which had been buried here. Most dedicated cocaine users are also dedicated nail biters, and Ace was no exception. He had no fingernails to pry with, and he couldn't get the lid off. The paint around the rim had dried to an obstinate glue. With a grunt of frustration and rage, Ace pulled out his pocket knife, got the blade under the can's rim, and levered the cover off. He peered in eagerly. Bills! Sheafs and sheafs of bills! With a cry, he seized them, pulled them out, and saw that his eagerness had deceived him. It was only more trading stamps, red ball stamps this time, a kind which had been redeemable only south of the Mason-Dixon line, and there only until 1964, when the company had gone out of business. Shit fire and save matches, Ace cried. He threw the stamps aside. They unfolded and began to tumble away in the light, hot breeze that had sprung up. Some of them caught and fluttered from the weeds like dusty banners. Cunt! Bastard! Son of a whore! He rooted in the can, even turned it over to see if there was anything taped to the bottom, and found nothing. He threw it away, stared at it for a moment, then rushed over and booted it like a soccer ball. He felt in his pocket for the map again. There was one panicky second when he was afraid it wasn't there, that he had lost it somehow, but he had only pushed it all the way down to the bottom in his eagerness to get cracking. He yanked it out and looked at it. The other cross was out behind the barn, and suddenly a wonderful idea came into Ace's mind, lighting up the angry darkness in there like a Roman candle on the 4th of July. The can he had just dug up was a blind. Pop might have thought someone would tumble to the fact that he had marked his various stashes with flat rocks. Thus, he had practiced a little of the old bait and switch out here at the Camber place, just to be safe. A hunter who found one useless treasure trove would never guess that there was another stash right here on this same property, but in a more out-of-the-way place. "Unless they had a map," Ace whispered, "like I do." He grabbed the pick and shovel and raced for the barn, eyes wide, sweaty, graying hair matted to the sides of his head. He saw the old airflow trailer and ran toward it. He was almost there when his foot struck something and he fell sprawling to the ground. He was up in a moment, looking around. He saw what he had stumbled over at once. It was a shovel, one with fresh dirt on the blade. A bad feeling began to creep over Ace, a very bad feeling indeed. It began in his belly, then spread upward to his chest and down to his balls. His lips peeled back from his teeth, very slowly, in an ugly snarl. He got to his feet and saw the rock marker lying nearby, dirt side up. It had been thrown aside. Someone had been here first, and not long ago, from the look. Someone had beaten him to the treasure.
"No,"
he whispered. The word fell from his snarling mouth like a drop of tainted blood or infected saliva.
"No!"
Not far from the shovel and the uprooted rock, Ace saw a pile of loose dirt which had been scraped indifferently back into a hole. Ignoring both his own tools and the shovel which the thief had left behind, Ace fell on his knees again and began pawing dirt out of the hole. In no time at all, he had found the Crisco can. He brought it out and pried off the lid. There was nothing inside but a white envelope. Ace took it out and tore it open. Two things fluttered out, a sheet of folded paper and a smaller envelope. Ace ignored the second envelope for the time being and unfolded the paper. It was a typed note. His mouth dropped open as he read his own name at the top of the sheet. "Dear Ace, I can't be sure you'll find this, but there's no law against hoping. Sending you to Shawshank was fun, but this has been even better. I wish I could see your face when you finish reading this. Not long after I sent you up, I went to see Pop. I saw him pretty often, once a month, in fact. We had an arrangement. He gave me $100 a month, and I let him go on making his illegal loans, all very civilized. Halfway through this particular meeting, he excused himself to use the toilet. 'Something he et,' he said. Ha ha! I took the opportunity to peek in his desk, which he had left unlocked. Such carelessness was not like him, but I think he was afraid he might load his pants if he didn't go to visit his Uncle John right away. Ha! I only found one item of interest, but that one was a corker. It looked like a map. There were lots of crosses on it, but one of the crosses, the one marking this spot, was marked in red. I put the map back before Pop returned. He never knew I looked at it. I came out here right after he died and dug up this Crisco can. There was better than $200,000 in it, Ace. Don't worry, though. I decided to share and share alike, and I'm going to leave you exactly what you deserve. Welcome back to town, Ace Hole. Yours sincerely, Alan Pangborn, Castle County Sheriff. P.S. A word to the wise, Ace. Now that you know, take your lumps and forget the whole thing. You know the old saying, finders keepers. If you ever try to brace me about your uncle's money, I will tear you a new asshole and stuff your head into it. Trust me on this. A.P. Ace let the sheet of paper slide from his numb fingers and opened the second envelope. A single $1 bill fell out of it. I decided to share and share alike, and am going to leave you exactly what you deserve.
You crab-infested bastard,
Ace whispered, and picked up the dollar bill with shaking fingers. Welcome back to town, Ace Hole.
You son of a whore!
Ace screamed so loudly that he felt something in his throat strain and almost rupture. The echo came back dimly. Whore, whore, whore. He began to tear the dollar up, then forced his fingers to relax. Uh-uh. No way, Jose. He was going to save this. The son of a bitch had wanted Pop's money, had he? He had stolen what rightfully belonged to Pop's last living relative, had he? Well, all right. Good. Fine. But he should have all of it. And Ace intended to see that the sheriff had just that. So after he removed Pussbag's testicles with his pocket knife, he intended to stuff this dollar bill into the bloody hole where they had been. You want the money, Daddy-O? Ace asked in a soft, musing voice. Okay. That's okay. No problem. No fucking problem. He got to his feet and began walking back toward the car in a stiff, staggering version of his usual hood strut. By the time he got there, he was almost running. By 5:45, a weird twilight had begun to creep over Castle Rock. Thunderheads were stacking up on the southern horizon. Low, distant boomings muttered over the woods and fields from that direction. The clouds were moving toward town, growing as they came. The streetlights, governed by a master photoelectric cell, came on a full half hour earlier than they usually did at that time of the year. Lower Main Street was a crowded confusion. It had been overrun by state police vehicles and TV news vans. Radio calls crackled and entwined in the hot, still air. TV technicians paid out cable and yelled at the people, kids mostly, who tripped over the loose lengths of it before they could anchor it temporarily to the pavement with duct tape. Photographers from 4 daily papers stood outside the barricades in front of the municipal building and took stills which would appear on front pages the following day. A few locals, surprisingly few if anyone had bothered to notice such things, rubbernecked. A TV correspondent stood in the glare of a high-intensity lamp and taped his report with the municipal building in the background. A senseless wave of violence swished through Castle Rock this afternoon, he began, and then stopped. Swished? He asked himself disgustedly. Shit, let's take it again from the top. To his left, a TV dude from another station was watching his crew prepare for what would be a live feed in less than 20 minutes. More of the onlookers had been drawn to the familiar faces of the TV correspondents than to the barricades, where there had been nothing to see since two orderlies from medical assistance had brought out the unfortunate Lester Pratt in a black plastic bag, loaded him into the back of their ambulance, and driven away. Upper Main, away from the blue strobes of the state police cruisers and the bright pools of the TV lights, was almost entirely deserted. Almost. Every now and then, a car or a pickup truck would park in one of the slant spaces in front of Needful Things. Every now and then, a pedestrian would saunter up to the new shop, where the display lights were off and the shade was pulled down on the door under the canopy. Every now and then, one of the rubberneckers on Lower Main would break away from the shifting knot of onlookers and walk up the street, past the vacant lot where the Emporium Galorium had once stood. Past you so-and-so, closed and dark, to the new store. No one noticed this trickle of visitors. Not the police, not the camera crews, not the correspondents, not the majority of the bystanders. They were looking at the scene of the crime, and their backs were turned to the place where, less than 300 yards away, the crime was still going on. If some disinterested observer had been keeping an eye on Needful Things, he or she would have quickly detected a pattern. The visitors approached. The visitor saw the sign in the window which read, "Closed until further notice." The visitors stepped back, identical expressions of frustration and distress on their faces. They looked like hurting junkies who had discovered the pusher man wasn't where he'd promised to be. "What do I do now?" their faces said. Most stepped forward to read the sign again, as if a second, closer scrutiny would somehow change the message. A few got into their cars and left, or wandered down toward the municipal building to stare at the free show for a while, looking dazed and vaguely disappointed. On the faces of most, however, an expression of sudden comprehension dawned. They had the look of people suddenly understanding some basic concept, like how to diagram simple sentences or reduce a pair of fractions to their lowest common denominator. These people walked around the corner to the service alley, which ran behind the business buildings on Main Street, the alley where Ace had parked the Tucker Talisman the night before. 40 feet down, an oblong of yellow light fell out of an open door and across the patched concrete. This light grew slowly brighter as day slipped into evening. A shadow lay in the center of the oblong, like a silhouette cut from mourner's crepe. The shadow belonged, of course, to Leland Gaunt. He had placed a table in the doorway. On it was a Roy Tan cigar box. He put the money which his customers tendered into this box and made change from it. These patrons approached hesitantly, even fearfully in some cases, but all of them had one thing in common. They were angry people with heavy grudges to tote. A few, not many, turned away before they reached Mr. Gaunt's makeshift counter. Some went running, with the wide eyes of men and women who have glimpsed a frightful fiend licking its chops in the shadows. Most, however, stayed to do business, and as Mr. Gaunt bantered with them, treating this odd backdoor commerce as an amusing diversion at the end of a long day, they relaxed. Mr. Gaunt had enjoyed his shop, but he never felt so comfortable behind plate glass and under a roof as he did here, on the edge of the air, with the first breezes of the coming storm stirring his hair. The shop, with its clever display lights on ceiling-mounted tracks, was all right. But this was better. This was always better. He had begun business many years ago as a wandering peddler on the blind face of a distant land, a peddler who carried his wares on his back, a peddler who usually came at the fall of darkness and was always gone the next morning, leaving bloodshed, horror, and unhappiness behind him. Years later, in Europe, as the plague raged and the dead carts rolled, he had gone from town to town and country to country in a wagon drawn by a slat-thin white horse with terrible burning eyes and a tongue as black as a killer's heart. He had sold his wares from the back of the wagon and was gone before his customers, who paid with small ragged coins or even in barter, could discover what they had really bought. Times changed. Methods changed, faces too. But when the faces were needful, they were always the same, the faces of sheep who have lost their shepherd. And it was with this sort of commerce that he felt most at home, most like that wandering peddler of old, standing not behind a fancy counter with a suite of cash register nearby, but behind a plain wooden table, making change out of a cigar box and selling them the same item over and over and over again. The goods which had so attracted the residents of Castle Rock, the black pearls, the holy relics, the carnival glass, the pipes, the old comic books, the baseball cards, the antique kaleidoscopes, were all gone. Mr. Gaunt had gotten down to his real business, and at the end of things, the real business was always the same. The ultimate item had changed with the years, just like everything else, but such changes were surface things, frosting of different flavors on the same dark and bitter cake. At the end, Mr. Gaunt always sold them weapons, and they always bought. "Why, thank you, Mr. Warburton," Mr. Gaunt said, taking a $5 bill from the black janitor. He handed him back a single and one of the automatic pistols Ace had brought from Boston. "Thank you, Miss Milliken." He took 10 and gave back 8. He charged them what they could afford, not a penny more or a penny less. "Each according to his means," was Mr. Gaunt's motto, and never mind each according to his needs, because they were all needful things, and he had come here to fill their emptiness and end their aches. "Good to see you, Mr. Emerson." Oh, it was always good, so very good, to be doing business in the old way again. And business had never been better. John Pangborn wasn't in Castle Rock. While the reporters and the state police gathered at one end of Main Street, and Leland Gaunt conducted his going-out-of-business sale halfway up the hill, Alan was sitting in the nurses' station of the Bloomer Wing in Northern Cumberland Hospital in Bridgeton. The Bloomer Wing was small, only 14 patient rooms, but what it lacked in size, it made up for in color. The walls of the inpatient rooms were painted in bright primary shades. A mobile hung from the ceiling in the nurses' station, the birds depending from it swinging and dipping gracefully around a central spindle. Alan was sitting in front of a huge mural which depicted a medley of Mother Goose rhymes. One section of the mural showed a man leaning across a table, holding something out to a small boy, obviously a hick, who looked both frightened and fascinated. Something about this particular image had struck Alan, and a snatch of childhood rhyme rose like a whisper in his mind. Simple Simon met a pieman going to the fair. Simple Simon, said the pieman, come and taste my wares. A ripple of goose flesh had broken out on Alan's arms, tiny bumps like beads of cold sweat. He couldn't say why, and that seemed perfectly normal. Never in his entire life had he felt as shaken, as scared, as deeply confused as he did right now. Something totally beyond his ability to understand was happening in Castle Rock. It had become clearly apparent only late this afternoon, when everything had seemed to blow sky high at once, but it had begun days, maybe even a week ago. He didn't know what it was, but he knew that Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jurczyk had only been the first outward signs. And he was terribly afraid that things were still progressing while he sat here with Simple Simon and the pieman. A nurse, Miss Hendry, according to the small nameplate on her breast, walked up the corridor on faintly squeaking crepe soles, weaving her way gracefully among the toys which littered the hall. When Alan came in, half a dozen kids, some with limbs in casts or slings, some with the partial baldness he associated with chemotherapy treatments, had been playing in the hall, trading blocks and trucks, shouting amiably to each other. Now it was the supper hour, and they had gone either down to the cafeteria or back to their rooms. How is he? Alan asked Miss Hendry. No change. She looked at Alan with a calm expression which contained an element of hostility. Sleeping. He should be sleeping. He has had a great shock. What do you hear from his parents? We called the father's place of employment in South Paris. He had an installation job over in New Hampshire this afternoon. He's left for home, I understand, and will be informed when he arrives. He should get here around 9, I would think, but of course it's impossible to tell. What about the mother? I don't know, Miss Hendry said. The hostility was more apparent now, but it was no longer aimed at Alan. I didn't make that call. All I know is what I see. She's not here. This little boy saw his brother commit suicide with a rifle, and although it happened at home, the mother is not here yet. You'll have to excuse me now. I have to fill the med cart.
Of course, Alan muttered.
He watched her as she started away, then rose from his chair. Miss Hendry? She turned to him. Her eyes were still calm, but her raised brows expressed annoyance. Miss Hendry, I really do need to talk with Sean Rusk. I think I need to talk to him very badly. Oh? Her voice was cool. Something... Alan suddenly thought of Polly and his voice cracked. He cleared his throat and pushed on. Something is going on in my town. The suicide of Brian Rusk is only part of it, I believe. And I also believe that Sean Rusk may have the key to the rest of it. Sheriff Pangborn, Sean Rusk is only 7 years old, and if he does know something, why aren't there other policemen here? Other policemen, he thought. What she means are qualified policemen. Policemen who don't interview 11-year-old boys on the street and then send them home to commit suicide in the garage. Because they've got their hands full, Alan said, and because they don't know the town the way that I do. I see. She turned to go again. Miss Hendry. Sheriff, I'm short-handed this evening and very bi- Brian Rusk wasn't the only Castle Rock fatality today. There were at least three others. Another man, the owner of the local tavern, has been taken to the hospital in Norway with gunshot trauma. He may live, but it's going to be touch and go with him for the next 36 hours or so, and I have a hunch the killing isn't done. He had finally succeeded in capturing all of her attention. You believe Sean Rusk knows something about this? He may know why his brother killed himself. If he does, that may open up the rest of it. So if he wakes up, will you tell me? She hesitated, then said, That depends on his mental state when he does, Sheriff. I'm not going to allow you to make a hysterical little boy's condition worse, no matter what is going on in your town. I understand. Do you? Good. She gave him a look which said, Just sit there and don't make trouble for me then, and went back behind the high desk. She sat down, and he could hear her putting bottles and boxes on the med cart. Alan got up, went to the payphone in the hall, and dialed Polly's number again. And once again it simply rang on and on. He dialed you so-and-so, got the answering machine, and racked the phone. He went back to his chair, sat in it, and stared at the Mother Goose mural some more. You forgot to ask me one question, Miss Hendry, Alan thought. You forgot to ask me why I'm here if there's so much going on in the seat of the county I was elected to preserve and protect. You forgot to ask me why I'm not leading the investigation while some less essential officer, old Seat Thomas, for instance, sits here waiting for Sean Rusk to wake up. You forgot to ask those things, Miss Hendry, and I know a secret. I'm glad you forgot. That's the secret. The reason was as simple as it was humiliating. Except in Portland and Bangor, murder belonged not to the sheriff's office, but to the state police. Henry Peyton had winked at that in the wake of Nettie and Wilma's duel, but he was not winking anymore. He couldn't afford to. Representatives of every Southern Maine newspaper and TV station were either in Castle Rock right now or on their way. They would be joined by their colleagues from all over the state before very much longer. And if this really was not over, as Alan suspected, they would shortly be joined by more media people from points south. That was the simple reality of the situation, but it didn't change the way Alan felt. He felt like a pitcher who can't get the job done and is sent to the showers by the coach. It was an indescribably shitty way to feel. He sat in front of Simple Simon and once again began to add up the score. Lester Pratt, dead. He had come to the sheriff's office in a jealous frenzy and had attacked John LaPointe. It was over his girl, apparently, although John had told Alan before the ambulance came that he had not dated Sally Ratcliffe in over a year. I only saw her to speak to once in a while on a street, and even then she cut me dead most of the time. She decided I'm one of the hellbound. He had touched his broken nose and winced. Right now, I feel hellbound. John was now hospitalized in Norway with a broken nose, a fractured jaw, and possible internal injuries. Sheila Brigham was also in the hospital. Shock. Hugh Priest and Billy Tupper were both dead. That news had come in just as Sheila was beginning to fall apart. The call came from a beer delivery man who'd had the sense to call medical assistance before calling the sheriff. The man had been almost as hysterical as Sheila Brigham, and Alan hadn't blamed him. By then, he had been feeling pretty hysterical himself. Henry Beaufort, in critical condition as a result of multiple gunshot wounds. Norris Ridgwick, missing, and that somehow hurt the most. Alan had looked around for him after receiving the delivery man's call, but Norris was just gone. Alan had assumed at the time that he must have gone outside to formally arrest Danforth and would return with the head selectman in tow, but events shortly proved that no one had arrested Keaton. Alan supposed the Stateys would arrest him if they ran across him while they pursued other lines of investigation, but otherwise, no. They had more important things to do. In the meantime, Norris was just gone. Wherever he was, he'd gotten there on foot. When Alan left town, Norris's VW had still been lying on its side in the middle of Lower Main Street. The witnesses said Buster had crawled into his Cadillac through the window and simply driven away. The only person who had tried to stop him had paid a steep price. Scott Garson was hospitalized here at Northern Cumberland with a broken jaw, broken cheekbone, broken wrist, and 3 broken fingers. It could have been worse. The bystanders claimed Buster had actively tried to run the man down as he lay in the street. Lenny Partridge, broken collarbone, 2 broken ribs, was also here someplace. Andy Clutterbuck had weighed in with news of this fresh disaster while Alan was still trying to comprehend the fact that the town's head selectman was now a fugitive from justice handcuffed to a big red Cadillac. Hugh Priest had apparently stopped Lenny, tossed him across the road, and driven away in the old man's car. Alan supposed they would find Lenny's car in the parking lot of the Mellow Tiger, since Hugh had bitten the dust there. And, of course, there was Brian Rusk, who had eaten a bullet at the ripe old age of 11. Clut had barely begun to tell his tale when the phone rang again. Sheila was gone by then, and Alan had picked up on the voice of a screaming, hysterical little boy, Sean Rusk, who had dialed the number on the bright orange sticker beside the kitchen telephone. All in all, medical assistance ambulances and rescue service units from four different towns had made afternoon stops in Castle Rock. Now, sitting with his back to Simple Simon in the pieman, watching the plastic birds as they swung and dipped around their spindle, Alan turned once more to Hugh and Lenny Partridge. Their confrontation was hardly the biggest to take place in Castle Rock today, but it was one of the oddest, and Alan sensed that a key to this business might be hidden in its very oddity. Why in God's name didn't Hugh take his own car if he had a hard-on for Henry Beaufort? Alan had asked Clut, running his hands through hair which was already wildly disarranged. Why bother with Lenny's old piece of shit? Because Hugh's Buick was standing on four flats. Looked like somebody ripped the shit out of them with a knife. Clut had shrugged, looking uneasily at the shambles the sheriff's office had become. Maybe he thought Henry Beaufort did it. Yes, Alan thought now, maybe so. It was crazy, but was it any crazier than Wilma Jerzyk thinking Nettie Cobb had first splattered mud on her sheets and then thrown rocks through the windows of her house? Any crazier than Nettie thinking Wilma had killed her dog? Before he had a chance to question Clut any further, Henry Payton had come in and told Alan, as kindly as he could, that he was taking the case. Alan nodded. There's one thing you need to find out, Henry, as soon as you can. What's that, Alan? Henry had asked, but Alan saw, with a sinking feeling, that Henry was listening to him with only half an ear. His old friend, the first real friend Alan had made in the wider law enforcement community after winning the job as sheriff and a very valuable friend he had turned out to be, was already concentrating on other things. How he would deploy his forces, given the widespread of the incidents, was probably chief among them. You need to find out if Henry Beaufort was as angry at Hugh Priest as Hugh apparently was with him. You can't ask him now. I understand he's unconscious, but when he wakes up, "Will do," Henry said, and clapped Alan on the shoulder. "Will do." Then, raising his voice, "Brooks, Morrison, over here." Alan watched him move off and thought of going after him, of grabbing him and making him listen. He didn't do it because Henry and Hugh and Lester and John, even Wilma and Nettie, were beginning to lose any feeling of real importance to him. The dead were dead. The wounded were being looked after. The crimes had been committed. Except Alan had a terrible, sneaking suspicion that the real crime was still going on. When Henry had walked away to brief his men, Alan had called Clut over once again. The deputy came with his hands stuffed into his pockets and a morose look on his face. "We've been replaced, Alan," he said, "taken right out of the picture. God damn!" "Not entirely," Alan said, hoping he sounded as if he really believed this. "You're going to be my liaison here, Clut." "Where are you going?" "To the Rusk house." But when he got there, both Brian and Sean Rusk were gone. The ambulance, which was taking care of the unfortunate Scott Garson, had swung by to pick up Sean. They were on their way to Northern Cumberland Hospital. Harry Samuels' second hearse, an old converted Lincoln, had gotten Brian Rusk and would take him to Oxford, pending autopsy. Harry's better hearse, the one he referred to as the company car, had already left for the same place with Hugh and Billy Tupper. Alan thought, the bodies will be stacked in that tiny morgue over there like cordwood. It was when he got to the Rusk home that Alan realized, in his gut as well as in his head, how completely he had been taken out of the play. Two of Henry's CID men were there ahead of him, and they made it clear that Alan could hang around only as long as he didn't try to stick in an oar and help them row. He had stood in the kitchen doorway for a moment, watching them, feeling about as useful as a third wheel on a motor scooter. Cora Rusk's responses were slow, almost doped.
Alan thought it might be shock, or perhaps the ambulance attendants who were transporting her remaining son to the hospital had given her some prescription mercy before they left. She reminded him eerily of the way Norris had looked as he had crawled from the window of his overturned VW. Whether it was because of a tranquilizer or just shock, the detectives weren't getting much value from her. She wasn't quite weeping, but she was clearly unable to concentrate on their questions enough to make helpful responses. She didn't know anything, she told them. She had been upstairs, taking a nap. Poor Brian, she kept saying. Poor, poor Brian. But she expressed this sentiment in a drone, which Alan found creepy, and she kept toying with a pair of old sunglasses which lay beside her on the kitchen table. One of the bows had been mended with adhesive tape, and one of the lenses was cracked. Alan had left in disgust and come here to the hospital. Now he got up and went to the pay telephone down the hall in the main lobby. He tried Polly again, got no answer, and then dialed the sheriff's office. The voice which answered growled, "State Police," and Alan felt a childish surge of jealousy. He identified himself and asked for Klutt. After a wait of almost 5 minutes, Klutt came on the line. "Sorry, Alan. They just let the phone lay there on the desk. Lucky I came over to check it, you'd still be waiting. Darned old stateies don't care one bit about us." "Don't worry about it, Klutt. Has anyone collared Keaton yet?" "Well, I don't know how to tell you this, Alan, but..." Alan felt a sinking in the pit of his stomach and closed his eyes. He had been right. It wasn't over. "Just tell me," he said. "Never mind the protocol." "Buster, Danforth, I mean, drove home and used a screwdriver to knock the door handle off his Cadillac. You know, where he was cuffed." "I know," Alan agreed. His eyes were still shut. "Well, he killed his wife, Alan, with a hammer. It wasn't a state cop that found her, because the stateies weren't much interested in Buster up to 20 minutes ago. It was Seat Thomas. He drove by Buster's house to double-check. He reported in what he found and got back here not 5 minutes ago. He's having chest pains, he says, and I'm not surprised. He told me that Buster took her face about right off, said there's guts and hair every place. There's a platoon or so of Peyton's Blue Jackets up there on the view now. I put Seat in your office. Figured he'd better sit down before he fell down." "Jesus Christ, Klutt. Take him over to Ray Van Allen, fast. He's 62 and been smoking Camels all his damn life." "Ray went to Oxford, Allen. He's trying to help the doctors patch up Henry Beaufort." "His PA, then. What's his name?" "Frankel. Everett Frankel." "Not around. I tried both the office and his house." "Well, what's his wife say?" "Eb's a bachelor, Allen." "Oh, Christ." Someone had scrawled a bit of graffiti over the telephone. "Don't worry, be happy," it said. Alan considered this sourly. "I can take him to the hospital myself," Klutt offered. "I need you right where you are," Alan said. "Have the reporters and TV people shown up?" "Yeah, the place is crawling with them." "Well, check on Seat as soon as we're done here. If he doesn't feel any better, here's what you do. Go out front, grab a reporter who looks halfway bright to you, deputize him, and have him drive Seat over here to Northern Cumberland." "Okay." Klutt hesitated, then burst out, "I wanted to go over to the Keaton place, but the state police, they won't let me onto the crime scene. How do you like that, Alan? Those bastards won't let a county deputy sheriff onto the crime scene." "I know how you feel. I don't like it much myself, but they're doing their job. Can you see Seat from where you are, Klutt?" "Yeah." "Well, is he alive?" "He's sitting behind your desk, smoking a cigarette and looking at this month's rural law enforcement." "Right," Alan said. He felt like laughing or crying or doing both at the same time. "That figures. Has Polly Chalmers called, Klutt?" "No. Wait a minute. Here's the log. I thought it was gone. She did call, Alan, just before 3:30. Alan grimaced. "I know about that one. Anything later?" Not that I can see here, but that doesn't mean much. With Sheila gone and these darned old state bears clumping around, who can tell for sure?" "Thanks, Klutt. Is there anything else I should know?" "Yeah, a couple of things." "Shoot." "They've got the gun Hugh used to shoot Henry, but David Friedman from State Police Ballistics says he doesn't know what it is. An automatic pistol of some kind, but the guy said he's never seen one quite like it." "Are you sure it was David Friedman?" Alan asked. "Friedman, yeah, that was the guy's name. He must know. Dave Friedman's a walking shooter's Bible." Yeah, he doesn't, though. I stood right there while he was talking to your pal Peyton. He said it's a little like a German Mauser, but it lacked the normal markings and the slide was different. I think they sent it to Augusta with about a ton of other evidence. What else? They found an anonymous note in Henry Beaufort's yard, Klutz said. It was crumpled into a ball beside his car. You know that classic T-Bird of his? It was vandalized, too, just like Hugh's. Alan felt as if a large, soft hand had just whacked him across the face. What did the note say, Klutz? Just a minute. He heard a faint, quick, quick sound as Klutz paged through his notebook. Here it is. Don't you ever cut me off and then keep my car keys, you damn frog. Frog? That's what it says. Klutz giggled nervously. The word ever and the word frog have got lines drawn under them. And you say the car was vandalized? That's right. Tires slashed, just like Hugh's, and a big long scratch down the passenger side. Ouch. Okay, Alan said. Here's something else for you to do. Go to the barber shop. And then to the billiard parlor if you need to. Find out who it was Henry cut off, this week or last. But the state police... Fuck the state police, Alan said feelingly. It's our town. We know who to ask and where to find them. Do you want to tell me you can't lay hands on someone who'll know this story in just about 5 minutes? Of course not, Klutz said. I saw Charlie Fortin when I came back from Castle Hill, noodling with a bunch of guys in front of the Western Auto. If Henry was bumping heads with somebody, Charlie will know who. Hell, the Tiger's Charlie's home away from home. Yes, but were the state police questioning him? Well, no. No. So you question him. But I think we both already know the answer, don't we? Hugh Priest, Klutz said. It has the unmistakable clang of a ringer to me, Alan said. He thought, this is maybe not so different from Henry Peyton's first guess after all. Okay, Alan, I'll get on it. And call me back the minute you know for sure, the second. He gave Klutz the number, then made him recite it back so he could be sure Klutz had copied it down correctly. I will, Klutz said, and then burst out furiously, what's going on, Alan? God damn it, what's going on around here? I don't know. Alan felt very old, very tired, and angry. No longer angry at Peyton for shunning him off the case, but angry at whoever was responsible for these gruesome fireworks. And he felt more and more sure that when they got to the bottom of it, they would discover that a single agency had been at work all along. Wilma and Nettie, Henry and Hugh, Lester and John. Someone had wired them together like packets of high explosive. I don't know, Klutz, but we're going to find out. He hung up and dialed Polly's number again, his urge to make things right with her, to understand what had happened to make her so furious with him, was fading. The replacement feeling, which had begun to creep over him, was even less comforting, a deep, unfocused dread, a growing feeling that she was in danger. Ring, 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 but no answer. Polly, I love you and we need to talk. Please pick up the phone. Polly, I love you and we need to talk. Please pick up the phone. Polly, I love you. The litany ran around in his head like a wind-up toy. He wanted to call Klutz back and ask him to check on her right away, before he did anything else, but couldn't. That would be very wrong when there might be other packets of explosives still waiting to explode in the rock. Yes, but Alan, suppose Polly's one of them. That thought poked some buried association loose, but he was unable to grasp it before it floated away. Alan slowly hung up the telephone, cutting it off in mid-ring as he settled it into its cradle. Polly could stand it no longer. She rolled on her side, reached for the telephone, and it stilled in mid-ring. Good, she thought. But was it? She was lying on her bed, listening to the sound of approaching thunder. It was hot upstairs, as hot as the middle of July. But opening the windows was not an option because she'd had Dave Phillips, one of the local handymen and caretakers, put on her storm windows and doors just the week before. So she had taken off the old jeans and shirt she had worn on her expedition to the country and folded them neatly over the chair by the door. Now she lay on the bed in her underwear, wanting a little nap before she got up and showered, but unable to go to sleep. Some of it was the sirens, but more of it was Alan,
what Alan had done. She could not comprehend this grotesque betrayal of all she had believed and all she had trusted, but neither could she escape it. Her mind would turn to something else, those sirens, for instance, and how they sounded like the end of the world. And then, suddenly, it would be there again, how he had gone behind her back, how he had sneaked. It was like being poked by the splintery end of a board in some tender, secret place. "Oh, Alan, how could you?" she asked him, and herself, again. The voice which replied surprised her. It was Aunt Evie's voice, and beneath the dry lack of sentiment that had always been her way, Polly felt a disquieting, powerful anger. "If you had told him the truth in the first place, girl, he never would have had to." Polly sat up quickly. That was a disturbing voice, all right, and the most disturbing thing about it was the fact that it was her own voice. Aunt Evie was many years dead. This was her own subconscious, using Aunt Evie to express its anger, the way a shy ventriloquist might use his dummy to ask a pretty girl for a date and... "Stop it, girl. Didn't I once tell you this town is full of ghosts? Maybe it is me. Maybe it is." Polly uttered a whimpering, frightened cry, and then pressed her hand against her mouth. "Oh, maybe 'tisn't. In the end, who it is don't matter much, does it? The question is this, Tricia. Who sinned first? Who lied first? Who covered up first? Who cast the first stone?" "That's not fair!" Polly shouted into the hot room, and then looked at her own frightened, wide-eyed reflection in the bedroom mirror. She waited for the voice of Aunt Evie to come back, and when it didn't, she slowly lay back down again. Perhaps she had sinned first, if omitting part of the truth and telling a few white lies was sinning. Perhaps she had covered up first. But did that give Alan the right to open an investigation on her, the way a law officer might open an investigation on a known felon? Did it give him the right to put her name on some interstate law enforcement wire, or send out a tracer on her, if that was what they called it, or... "Never mind, Polly." A voice, one she knew, whispered, "Stop tearing yourself apart over what was very proper behavior on your part. I mean, after all, you heard the guilt in his voice, didn't you?" "Yes," she muttered fiercely into the pillow. "That's right, I did. What about that, Aunt Evie?" There was no answer, only a queer, light tugging. "The question is this, Tricia," at her subconscious mind. As if she had forgotten something, left something out. "Would you like a sweet, Tricia?" of the equation. Polly rolled restlessly onto her side, and the Azka tumbled across the fullness of one breast. She heard something inside scratch delicately at the silver wall of its prison. "No," Polly thought, "it's just something shifting, something inert. This idea that there really is something alive in there, it's just your imagination." Scratch, scritch, scratch. The silver ball jiggled minutely between the white cotton cup of her bra and the coverlet of the bed. Scratchy, scritch, scratch. "That thing is alive, Tricia," Aunt Evie said. "That thing is alive, and you know it." "Don't be silly," Polly told her, tossing over to the other side. "How could there possibly be some creature in there? I suppose it might be able to breathe through all those tiny holes, but what in God's name would it eat?" "Maybe," Aunt Evie replied with a soft implacability, "it's eating you, Tricia." "Polly," she murmured. "My name is Polly." This time the tug at her subconscious mind was stronger, somehow alarming, and for a moment she was almost able to grasp it. Then the telephone began to ring again. She gasped and sat up, her face wearing a look of tired dismay. Pride and longing were at war there. "Talk to him, Tricia. What can it hurt? Better still, listen to him. You didn't do much of that before, did you?" "I don't want to talk to him, not after what he did." "But you still love him." Yes, that was true. The only thing was, now she hated him as well. The voice of Aunt Evie rose once more, gusting angrily in her mind. "Do you want to be a ghost all your life, Tricia? What's the matter with you, girl?" Polly reached out for the telephone in a mockery of decisiveness. Her hand, her limber, pain-free hand, faltered just short of the handset. Because maybe it wasn't Alan. Maybe it was Mr. Gaunt. Maybe Mr. Gaunt wanted to tell her that he wasn't finished with her yet, that she hadn't finished paying yet. She made another move toward the telephone. This time the tips of her fingers actually brushed the plastic casing, and then she drew back. Her hand clutched its partner, and they folded into a nervous ball on her belly. She was afraid of Aunt Evie's dead voice, of what she had done this afternoon, of what Mr. Gaunt, or Alan, might tell the town about her dead son, of what yonder confusion of sirens and racing cars might mean. But more than all of these things, she had discovered, she was afraid of Leland Gaunt himself. She felt as if someone had tied her to the clapper of a great iron bell, a bell which would simultaneously deafen her, drive her mad, and crush her to a pulp if it began to ring. The telephone fell quiet. Outside, another siren began to scream, and as it began to fade toward the tin bridge, the thunder rolled again, closer than ever now.
"Take it off," the voice of Aunt Evie whispered. "Take it off, honey. You can do it. His power is over need, not will. Take it off. Break his hold on you."
But she was looking at the telephone and remembering the night, was it less than a week ago, when she had reached for it and struck it with her fingers, knocking it to the floor. She remembered the pain which had clawed its way up her arm like a hungry rat with broken teeth. She couldn't go back to that. She just couldn't. Could she? "Something nasty's going on in the rock tonight," Aunt Evie said. "Do you want to wake up tomorrow and have to figure out how much of it was your nastiness? Is that really a score you want to add up, Tricia?" "You don't understand," she moaned. "It wasn't on Alan, it was on Ace. Ace Merrill, and he deserves whatever he gets." The implacable voice of Aunt Evie returned. "And so do you, honey. So do you." At 6:20 on that Tuesday evening, as the thunderheads neared and real dark began to overtake twilight, the state police officer who had replaced Sheila Brigham in dispatch came out into the sheriff's office bullpen. He skirted the large area, roughly diamond-shaped, which was marked with crime scene tape, and hurried over to where Henry Peyton stood. Peyton looked disheveled and unhappy. He had spent the previous 5 minutes with the ladies and gentlemen of the press, and he felt as he always did after one of these confrontations, as if he had been coated with honey and then forced to roll in a large pile of ant-infested hyena shit. His statement had not been as well prepared or as unassailably vague as he would have liked. The TV people had forced his hand. They wanted to do live updates during the 6 to 6:30 time slot when the local news was broadcast, felt they had to do live updates, and if he didn't throw them some kind of a bone, they were apt to crucify him at 11. They had almost crucified him anyway. He had come as close as he ever had in his entire career to admitting he didn't have a fucking clue. He had not left this impromptu press conference. He had escaped it. Peyton found himself wishing he had listened more closely to Alan. When he arrived, it had seemed that the job was essentially damage control. Now he wondered, because there had been another murder since he took the case, a woman named Myrtle Keaton. Her husband was still out there someplace, probably headed over the hills and far away by now, but just possibly still galloping gaily around this weird little town.